Representative Butler. And Mason, would you introduce our information meeting today?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, or present members of the committee, Oregon property tax has gone through a series of changes in the last 20 years or so. The presentation today by Larry Yellow from the office would reference to these differences and these changes, this history, give you an orientation on what needs some attention and what is just a course of business.
Thank you very much. If you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed, we're increasingly ready, as you can see.
Are you able to hear me with the mic?
What's that you said?
Are you able to hear me?
Oh, very well.
Good afternoon. I am Mary Ayala, and I'm an economist with the Legislative Revenue Office, here to give you an overview of property taxes in Oregon. This overview that I'm presenting to you will highlight some important issues that deal with local taxing districts' ability to fund local services. Part one will give you some historical perspective on Oregon's property taxes, the assessed values based on constitutional changes that were adopted in 1990 and 97, and it will also look at Oregon's taxes relative to other states on a per capita of taxes and property taxes per share of income. Part two will just cover the rate structure, which is a little more complicated. It deals with the property that's taxed, what's exempt, what's specially assessed, and most importantly, how the rate structure has been created to ensure that property taxes have limits and that funds are used for special purposes. Part three, will cover Oregon's property tax restrictions in some detail in order to show how they affect, how the structure itself affects local districts' ability to raise taxes or provide services or even maintain them at current levels. I'll provide several examples in order to illustrate why some local taxing districts can experience difficulties based on current limits, constitutional limits, that may not have been anticipated in 1990 or 97 when voters adopted them. This first table or chart will illustrate how tax rates and assessed values have changed since 1970. The first change is the decline in tax rates, which is the red line, caused by voters' adoption of Measure 5 in 1970. That was the first of two constitutional measures. Measure 5 forced rates to decline to no more than $10 per thousand real market value for non-school taxing districts and $5 for school taxing districts. After 1990, you can see how the red line drops from about $25 per thousand to the required limit over a phase-in period. Between 1990 and 1997, while tax rates were declining, taxable value of property measured as real market value continued to increase steadily. That's the blue line. Voters reacted unfavorably to the higher taxes by adopting Measure 47, which, due to some unworkable features, was subsequently revised to Measure 50. And that Measure 50 created a wedge, which is where the blue line deviates from that dotted line, reflecting the fact that taxes would be no longer imposed on real market value, but it would be imposed on assessed value, and assessed value would be a constructed value on each property that I'll go through examples and show you how that's computed. Here's an overview of just how much money was collected in property taxes in FY05-06, roughly $3.7 billion, and you can see from the table that roughly 46% of it went to education, another 19% went to counties, 23% went to the cities, the remainder went to special districts, such as fire districts and water districts and things like that. You can see that from the table there that there was an overall increase in growth of property taxes of about 3.6%, and you can see that some of the districts were able to increase that percentage by a higher rate overall over the entire state. Now, the high growth in real market values attributed to this ability to change that because of the measures that limit growth based on real market value. There has to be at least growth in real market value in order to increase the taxes. This chart will give you an overview of how Oregon stacks up with other states. It illustrates that taxes on a per capita basis, that's the red line, increased from about $800 to about $1,100 per person between 1996 and FY05-06. The annualized growth rate is about 3.5%. The chart also implies that property tax growth in Oregon has kept pace with income growth, which is why from 1996 forward, the ratio of property tax to personal income has remained at roughly 3%, as denoted by that flat blue line. Relative to other states, in FY05-06, property tax as a share of personal income was also about 3% in California, Washington, and Idaho. However, the other three states approached the 3% from lower rates, and Oregon approached it from above.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Explain that statement. They approached it from lower rates, and we approached it from above.
Oregon had a higher property tax rate as a share of personal income, and it decreased to 3%, whereas the other states had lower rates, and they've increased their rates since 1996.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Butler.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mary, the 3-plus percent on the graph, I'm concerned that the amount of and there's a special name for it, special assessed property or special use property. I'm concerned because subdivisions, new subdivisions, change of use of the property, and additions should all be there. Hasn't Oregon had a fairly healthy building boom?
Hasn't what?
Hasn't Oregon experienced a fairly healthy building boom that should have allowed that increase to be considerably more than the 3%?
Well, apparently in 05-06 it hasn't, but I can see your point. In special areas of the state, probably it has. Okay, but we're talking at the aggregate level right now, and when you get down into local districts, you're going to see a greater variation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Here I think you can look at Oregon with respect to all of the other states. Between 1999 and FY03-04, you can see that the current rate of about 3% of income appears to be the midpoint for ranking across all states. And then on a per capita tax basis, the blue line, the red lines, I should say, you can see that Oregon has actually improved. It's changed its ranking from 22 to 30 between 2001 and 2003-04. This means that in FY01-02, the average Oregonian was paying less in property taxes than persons in 22 other states, but in 03-04, he or she was paying less property taxes than persons in 30 other states. And that's basically, this is all aggregate data, and I will try to get you down into the local issues shortly. Okay. In summary then, basically, in taxes have increased to about $3.7 billion statewide, reflecting a 3.6% increase over the prior year. Per capita taxes ranged about $1,100 per person. The allocation across different types of districts in the aggregate, about 46% goes towards education, and 19% to counties, 23% to cities. And on average, the 3% rate as property tax as a share of income remains about 3% in Oregon, which is lower than 26 other states and appears to be the midpoint for most states. Now, of course, Oregon has a very unique property tax structure, which is why it's easy. It's fun to spend some time with it. It taxes real property. It taxes personal property. Does not tax intangibles. Okay. And The DOR, the Department of Revenue, performs assessments on utilities, communication service providers, and industrial property valued over $1 million. This function is called a DOR central assessment. Local assessment is performed on all other property, including industrial property valued at less than $1 million. Just as a note here, current telephone, landline, but not cable companies, are the communication project providers that are subject to central assessment by the DOR. In either 2008 or 2009, according to an August 2006 presentation that the DOR staff made to the House Interim Committee, the department has updated its interpretation of communication services, which was very outdated. And it will now include and intends to include in central assessment cable and internet providers. As such, it is indicated that it will begin assessment responsibilities over these providers in 2008 or 2009. Just a heads up on this, the importance of this is that anything that a cable company that is assessed locally, current law, does not get taxed on its intangibles. It's forbidden. But if these entities are now taxed or subject to tax by the Department of Revenue, the Department of Revenue will tax the intangibles. Okay, and so there's going to be some interest in that over this coming session.
Mary, I have a question on that topic. If I understand the issue correctly, and I may not, the department, when it evaluates, when it does the evaluation of value, does it on the basis of the business as an ongoing, as an operating company. And that would therefore result in the value of its real property, the value of its tangible personal property, and the value of its intangible property all being considered because it's being considered as a whole. Is that an accurate
That's correct.
Review?
That's correct. It uses.
So they don't explicitly evaluate intangible property. It's simply a piece of the enterprise which is being evaluated.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. They use what's called a unitary approach, which does not break out these items individually, but because it looks at the business as in its entirety, the intangibles are valued. They don't pull them out. They look at the business in its entirety, and so intangibles would, in effect, be part of the assessment. But local taxing authorities have to, there are ways to pull it out. I mean, if you were going to do a merger or an acquisition or a sell-off of a private company, you'd have to pull out and value intangible assets. So it's possible to do it, and the local authorities would have to do it for the cable companies under current law. Locals, but not the Department of Revenue.
Right. And the Department of Revenue deals with these issues now for businesses over a certain size or having a certain geographic spread?
Well,
or simply over a certain size?
It only imposes the intangible. Well, it only does the utilities that would use the unitary approach where intangibles would be valued. It only applies that to utilities. It doesn't apply that concept to industrials over $1 million.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair. Other questions? Yes, Representative
Thank
Butler.
You, Mr. Chair. And Mary, it's my understanding that the Department of Revenue is limited to who they can do that to. They couldn't go to a Portland law firm and say that you have $1 million worth of client goodwill, so therefore we're going to go ahead and just start assessing that goodwill. They're limited to the isn't it transportation and communications and energy? Are those the?
It's the big public utilities. I think it might include anything that usually covers a larger multi-jurisdictional, area. So it would include like your electric companies, your telecommunications companies, including cable and internet as of 2008, and probably transportation if there's some railroads, things like that.
There is a specific statute on that does delineate what those kinds of businesses are, and maybe we can look at that later.
Yes, yes, I'll be glad to give you this.
Thank you.
This table is just aimed at showing you just how the taxes are distributed by class of property. Between 1995 and 2005, there has really not been a major change and the share of taxes paid by each type of property. Residential property owners still continue to pay about 52%. You can see that farm and forest, recreation pay a lower percentage, but this is part of the property taxes special assessments program. It reflects public policy towards protecting certain types of lands in the state. In addition to special assessments, which we can have to favor certain types of land use, we also have property tax system has exemptions. Over 80% of the exemption value, that is taxes foregone, for all of the fully exempt properties in FY09-07-09 are reflected in this particular list. The estimated total exemption value is $16 billion per biennium, or $8 billion per fiscal year. The largest exemption here you can see is the exemption on intangible property, which comes to $11.1 billion in taxes foregone over an assessed value of about $364 billion, as reported by the Department of Revenue for 05-06.
Good question.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Mary, do local governments have the ability to impose property taxes on things which are presently exempt from taxation? For instance, would the local government have the ability to impose a tax on inventory if they decided to do so? And perhaps that's a question that you can answer for me later on.
I would have to find out.
Get back
for
to
you.
The committee chair and members with regard to what the authority is that local governments have to add exempt property to the list, and I'm specifically anxious about inventory taxation.
I will find out, and
thank you.
Shall I give everyone a response to that?
If you go through the chair, then that would be appropriate.
Okay.
Representative Berger?
Well, is inventory exempt?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that inventory has been exempt from from state property taxes since about 1970-something.
Mr. Chair, it's my memory that in the mid-90s, when I had a small business that was located in one county, I was paying county property taxes on my inventory.
Oh, inventory versus personal property?
No, inventory. Yeah, that's my memory.
Yeah.
It was part of the package of property taxes that my business paid to, you know, I was a...
And I'm not sure what year they ceased that, Mr. Chair.
The inventory tax was phased out during the time I was in practice as a psychologist, and that was between 1982 and 2001.
Yeah, so I was in the 90s.
It was you have a lot of clients laying around there or something?
It was in that period, yeah. Something like
keeping
that.
Something down.
Okay. Yeah, that's a change from my memory.
Holding something in reserve.
Yeah. The clients are not considered inventory. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one question to Mary on the federal
Representative
state?
Berger.
The federal, state, and local property tax, $4.2 billion. So if, for instance, the city of Salem were able to assess property taxes on this building for fire and police protection that is afforded them, that would be part of this.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Just wanted to make that point.
That'll be 95% of that number.
Okay.
This is an overview of the property tax rate structure. Just to illustrate, before we get into it in more detail, that there isn't a single rate that is... You may think you're being taxed at a single rate if you looked at your tax bill, and that's all you care about is the dollar amount that you're paying and the tax rate. But there are actually components of the tax rate that reflect the rate structure. And the permanent rate is the most general purpose rate used for operating expenses. A taxing district may impose a lower rate, but it may not exceed its maximum rate authority. Each taxing district was given a particular permanent rate back in 1997-98, and I will show you in a minute how that was computed. And that generally accounts for about 76% of all the taxes that are generated on a property. The remainder of that would be your general obligation bonds. Well, I'll define that in a minute. Your local options, your urban renewal special levies, which I should say there's an error there because I've highlighted that on your handouts. And here I've called that a renewal special levy, but actually that was the component of the permanent tax that is siphoned off. It's called the division of tax process that was given to the urban renewal agencies. The real amount for the special levy was about $33 million, and so you can add that to these two numbers to get to the actual amount that urban renewal planning agencies received in 05-06. Here's a description of how the property tax rate was actually computed in 1997-98 when voters by Measure 50 adopted this plan to, because taxes were so high, voters decided they wanted that the assessed value of each property to be set equal to its 1995-96 real market value less 10%. Then they took the levy amount, the amount of tax that had been extended in 97-98, or what would have, the authority that would have been granted in that year, and they took that authority less 17%, and created a permanent rate for each taxing district. Remember, there are 1,500 of them. Okay. And that, so there are 1,500 permanent rates out there. The other components of the rate structure would be the general obligation bonds, which are outside of Measure 50. That means when you start figuring out how much tax to impose on a property, everything is subject to that $10 limit for non-schools or $5 limit for schools, with the exception of the general obligation bond. You could tack on an extra rate there.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary, what happens if I have a new taxing district that becomes part of the municipalities that are serving my constituents? We add a new fire district in rural Marion County. What is their permanent tax base if we go back, if we're reaching back to the Measure 50 time?
I'm not exactly sure how they would actually compute the new rate for a new district in a particular code area, which I'll describe for you in a minute, but I am a little concerned about it, because if the other, as I describe a code area shortly, within a service area, with each property has certain taxing districts that provide services, and we've defined quite a few what are called code areas that mean that a set of homes or properties exist within a certain geographic space that are served by the same set of providers. If all of the providers in a particular code area had extended a tax rate and real market values were really flat in that area so that every single district had reached its highest rate, permanent rate, and there were no further
less than $10.
Yeah, and there was no further ability to raise rates because Measure 5 limits had already been reached. Then the existence of a new taxing district or a new service provider in that code area would force a certain amount of compression in order to maintain level 5.
So then they just divide that. Well, the concern I've got is, if you've already reached your $10, and you've got someone that's coming in as a new service provider, the voters decide they'd like to have a vector district or something of that nature, then they divide up the $10 pro rata on what everyone else,
and everyone else's rates would be compressed, assuming they were all at the maximum,
including the vector district.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
And that's one of the things, as I'll point out later through examples, that I don't think might have been anticipated a decade ago, because at that point, when assessed or real market values were rolled back to their 1995-96 values less 10% or something, there was this huge gap that was created for quite a while. And we saw it on the graph that I showed you, but that's not the case for lots of districts. In many smaller areas, real market value has not accelerated faster than assessed value by the formula that we're using, and so you get almost a very little gap. And when that happens, there are all kinds of little instance examples. The one that you just cited would be one, and I have two more that I can illustrate. We'll also kind of show what difficulties occur. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Nathan, the Representative Butler, the process is for the voters to vote first to create the area.
Certainly.
And then they would also vote for the
permanent tax rate.
Then Measure 5 issues come in.
But then if they're already in compression, it's my understanding that right. if then what happens is that everyone's tax rate is looked at, and then everything backs off. You don't change the permanent tax rate.
No.
You just compress everyone proportionately.
Right. Everybody suffers the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Let me just follow up, if I may, with Mazin.
Yep, Representative Butler. Yeah.
As a matter of course, and I'm sure we've got new districts, taxing districts, cropping up throughout the state. Is there any kind of a disclosure at the time? Well, I guess there's lots of opportunity for the various districts to come forward and scream bloody murder. But is there a mandatory disclosure as to what's going to happen to my city services or my county services when I get this new vector district? In other words, the people who are voting yes, I want to go control gophers or moles or whatever, do they have an opportunity to know that that's going to cost them one sheriff's deputy or 4 hours a week on the library?
I suspect there is some sort of price tag of any measure, because this has to go to the measure.
It's local,
but it's for the majority of electors. It's subject to double majority rule.
I appreciate that.
So once you're subject to the double majority rule, I think you would have to disclose within the ballot what type of impact you would
okay.
have.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Just to summarize this section then, our property tax structure is probably easier to understand if I can give you an example for the motivation. Back in 1990 and 97, the intent was to reduce property taxes, which after 1997 turned out to be a rather stable percentage of about 3%. The second intent was to impose some kind of limitation on the types of uses of tax revenues by creating a rate structure, the largest of which is permanent rate, and that can be used for the general fund or general operating expenditures. The other types of tax levies that can be imposed require a lot more effort. It requires a double majority vote. It requires approval locally, of course, and then there's limits on the types of uses. For example, a 10-year local option would be used for capital improvements. The five-year option might be used for less than a capital improvements, other particular projects. Part 3 will address some of the side effects of Oregon's property tax system, and it will bring to light some local concerns that may not have been anticipated a decade ago. In addition, I've added forest, a section that is not on the first page of the handout, and that's because some of the tax assessors that were planning to be here originally were going to talk to you about forest revenues, and they're not here today, so I've brought in a few slides for that purpose. At this point, it's kind of best to go back and take a look at some of the details about Measure 5 and 50 so that I can show you how it affects some of the local concerns today. As previously noted, Measure 5 is a $5 and $10 limit imposed on taxing districts' operating budgets. Note that the rate limits at that time were imposed on real market value, and it was not until Measure 50 in 1997 that AV assessed value was permitted to differ from AV or required to differ from assessed value. Here is the example, one example that I wanted to show you. The Measure 5 imposed a limit on two service areas, schools and non-school taxing districts. This is an important distinction because each taxing district's authority is limited to some degree by the authority of some but not all other taxing districts. This chart illustrates the interdependence that exists that Vice Chair Butler just asked about earlier, and it kind of gives you a good example of what might happen. Each district extends, let's say, its rates up to on property, after which these individual rates are summed up and sorted into the non-school and school categories to be tested against the Measure 5 and the Measure 10 limits. When the composite rate, I call them adding up these individual rates, are added together, the local options would be compressed first if something went over Measure 5. But let's assume that there was no local option involved here and that there was no compression. From this, if you add up these rates, you're going to assume real market value equals assessed value in this particular situation. And it wouldn't be a problem if there were a huge gap between real market value and assessed value. But let's say you add these up and you realize that they sum to $10, which is the limit, and so there's no compression involved in this particular scenario. But now let's suppose that one of the districts, say Baker City, actually had originally been given a $7.6 permanent rate and chose not to impose that, or extend that is the correct word. Okay. But this year it needs that much money, so it decides to extend that rate, and the other two districts do nothing. They keep their rates the same. Okay. But now if you add up the rates, with real market value equal to assessed value, you're now at $11 instead of $10, and you have to compress. Well, when you compress, you're not going to knock off the dollar from the, in this case, Baker City. It will be proportionally reduced. Okay, and so Baker City might end up, after you look at the proportions here to see how to use those proportions to back out that compression, the other two jurisdictions, Baker City won't get its full dollar, and the other two will get something, but the other two taxing districts will lose. And so this is the example Representative Butler made about having a situation where everybody is trying to maintain services, and two of the three districts here did nothing, but they're going to be compressed. The rates will be compressed. Moving on to Measure 50, the assessed value. This is assessed value of taxable property cannot exceed the lesser of its real market value or the maximum assessed value. And the maximum assessed value is determined initially in, it was determined initially in 1997 as each property's assessed value in 1995 less 10%. What do we do after that? Well, after that, let me go on to that. Here's an example of how assessed value is calculated after 1997. Okay? You have to, here's an example where you've got to take the greater of prior year's assessed maximum assessed value, let's say it's $89,000, or assessed value from last year times 1.3%, that's the maximum allowed, plus any exception value times the what's called the change percent ratio, and you get a total here of $100,000. Exception value is something like the addition, an addition to a home that has to be brought on the roll. It could be you added a garage to your house. That will be called exception value. If your house had been worth $89,000 and you added a garage to your house, the assessor would come out and he wouldn't value the garage at real market value. He'd multiply it by something called the change percent ratio, which is the value of assessed property to real market value in that county. And so in this case, you get the greater of two values, which is $100,640, but then you have to take step two and compare that to the lesser of that $100,000 or real market value. If real market value had been $50,000, well, your assessed value for 2005 would have been $50,000. In this case, though, real market value is $174,000, so you take the lesser of those two amounts. Without the numbers, here's the formula for assessed value. After the 1997 value was computed, the formula drives assessed value henceforth. Okay. To illustrate on a statewide basis the effects of compression, so far we've been very fortunate the statewide. The compression rate has been $52 million in 05-06, which is about 1.4% statewide. And you can see how that's distributed with respect to various options. You'd expect the local options, they would be the first ones to go. If you had compression, local options would be the first ones to be compressed, and then your permanent rate would be compressed. And you can see, like for county taxing districts, the compression rate has been slightly higher. These are, again, statewide totals. Okay. Two emerging issues are of great importance locally that deal with compression. First, it has a greater impact on local districts depending on the importance of property taxes to the taxing district's revenue structure. Among northeastern county taxing districts, that experienced a much higher compression rate, property taxes accounted for a large share of their revenues. Among urban districts, some local taxing districts can be adversely affected by compression, by the compression formula that is calculated when urban renewal areas are created or extended, and I'll give you an example of that at the close of this presentation. Third, county taxing districts located in western and southwestern Oregon have not experienced high compression rates. Their compression was, I think, about 0.4% in 05-06, but that is very likely to change because of the crisis that some of these county districts are facing right now with the removal of the federal forest payments, and that's an important component of their tax structure. I'll come back to the forest revenues after I deal with the urban renewal issue, which is a very important part of the economic development plan for the state and for a lot of local districts. Okay. It's the urban renewal program was a constitutional amendment authorizing urban renewal, authorizing it in 1960. The goal, of course, is to improve blighted areas in Oregon's cities and counties. Urban renewal agencies are formed, and the plans do not need voter approval. So the sponsor might be a city. Mostly they're cities. There are a few counties that sponsor them. And the source of the funding is called tax increment financing. And I'll explain that in this shortly. The revenue options for your urban renewal plans. Measure 50 required existing plans to choose one of three options. Most of them have, 85% have chosen option one, which is 100% of the division of tax plus a special levy up to the limit. Seven UR plans chose option three, which is to fix the amount for the both the division of tax and a special levy. And the third option is plans, well, that's mostly those two. And plans created after 1997-98 do not choose an option. They must choose 100% division of tax. Those are your three options. Division of tax, if I haven't, I will define it shortly, but here is an example of how many agencies there are and how they've grown since since 1999. And there are 60 today with 60 agencies with 81 UR plans, urban renewal plans. Just to give you some definitions on this, the division of tax and urban renewal special levy may only be used by UR agencies to pay off indebtedness and interest on indebtedness. It requires that all plans to take a maximum amount of a division of tax that is allowed to be calculated. However, agencies may amend their boundaries to change the plan's frozen and excess values and thereby impact the amount of division of tax available to the UR agency. It may amend the urban renewal plan to increase its amount of maximum indebtedness. And this, again, is not subject to voter approval. Okay. The urban renewal districts obtain their property taxes on the incremental value above a frozen property's frozen value. This is what's called tax increment pricing. The frozen value is going to be the assessed value of property, each property within an urban renewal plan area on the date that that plan is created. Okay. As the plan is implemented and properties are approved, the value of those properties should increase. That increase, that increment, is what is set aside to finance the improvements of the properties within the district, and so it's called tax increments finance. The division of tax is the formula, the process by which taxes are calculated. Okay. Any unused excess value, I said earlier that every urban renewal plan must, by law, collect all of the taxes on excess value in order to pay off its indebtedness. If there's any money left over, okay, during, let's say you have a plan to pay off debt over 30 years, if there's any money left over, that money will be reverted, will be turned back to the other taxing districts as unused excess value.
A question, can that amount decrease or increase from one year to the next, or is that once it's gone back into the frozen value, it stays there?
Are we talking about the unused excess?
Correct.
Unused excess would be property, right, that...
I understand the definition. It's a different question. The question was, can that amount fluctuate from year to year, depending upon the amount of the indebtedness?
Yes, I would think so.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay. It's calculated every year, and when I show you how it's calculated, you'll see that.
That takes care of it. Thank you. Yes.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair. All right. The division of tax totaled in FY05-06, it totaled about $124 million, up 5.4% from the prior years. Special levies total $33 million, and combined, they total $157 million, up 6.2% from the prior year. Both urban renewal, special levy taxes, and the division of tax are limited by general government, the $10 per thousand limit on property taxes. That's Measure 5's $10 limit. That is, in December 2001, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that urban renewal taxes must be categorized under the non-school $10 limit because of the purpose for which the taxes are used. But then the following example will highlight this additional information. This example will show you, hopefully, how an urban renewal plan division of tax and the court ruling could shift money away from other taxing districts into the urban renewal area. Let's assume, for example, that we start with a property in an urban renewal area that's worth $125,000 relative to assessed value of $100,000, and the tax rate is $12 per thousand in the non-school district and 5.25 in the school districts. The M5 limit, as I said earlier, is $10 per thousand real market value. So you can have a higher rate on assessed value if there is assessed, if real market values are generally higher than assessed value. Step one would be to calculate the amount that should, the frozen value, let's say, of this property is $60,000. This is when the property, when the urban renewal plan was created, that property was worth $60,000, and it's now got, an incremental value of $40,000 because of the improvements that were made in the plan area. To calculate how much tax should go to the urban renewal plan or urban renewal agency, first you have to calculate the 40%, which is the frozen value, the incremental value, is 40% of $100,000. So you multiply that times the AV rate of 5.25 times the $100,000, and you get $210 for the schools, $480 for the non-schools. This is for the UR area, the urban renewal area. You do the same thing for areas outside the UR area, and you apply the 60% rate, and you see, all right, schools are going to get $315, and the non-school districts will get $720. Now, keep track of these two numbers right here, the 210 and the 480, because the next step will be, because of the court ruling, it will take the $210 that had been originally in the calculated for the school district UR portion, and it shifts it down here into the non-school district because of the court ruling. So now, under the formula and the court ruling, the school districts will get $315. It doesn't violate Measure 5, which is the $5 limit, which would be $625. And the taxes in the non-school district sum up to $1,410. But rates have to be reduced to match the $1,250 Measure 5 limit imposed on non-schools. So when all is said and done, the taxing districts, the total will end up being $315 plus $1,250 plus will equal $1,565 and not the $1,775 that would have been allocated had you not shifted $210 away from the schools. Okay. Now, the other point that I want to make is that if you notice this formula right here, where you have $210 shifted from the UR formula down into non-school districts, now you've got to impose that compression, right, to get it down to $1,250 is the M5 limit. So in order to do that, you're going to proportionately reduce the taxes for each of these areas to get it down to $1,250, and you'll thereby compress the $720 that was going to the non-school, non-UR areas. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I understand, but I want to put it in a real term to see if a city was going to go out for an urban renewal district for a downtown area, that would not impact the state school fund, but if it put it into compression, it would decrease the revenue that was going to the county and the city if it was forced into compression because the city pursued that urban renewal district.
It would create some impact when those real market values are really close to assessed values, mm-hmm. right? Any action will have some redistributional effects. Okay, that we saw before, absent urban renewal. Right, but with the additional court ruling that throws the formula off slightly, it takes money out of the UR area school limit and puts it into the non-school formula. Other districts, say those that other $720 had originally been going to schools, outside of the UR area, or cities or counties, it's going to compress those rates. Yes, good question.
Okay, thank you.
Well, let's back up just for a second. We're dealing with the incremental value, aren't we? So the frozen value is not affected by this calculation, except to the extent that it may lead to compression.
The frozen value isn't, the values aren't affected, but the taxes are compressed.
Correct. And the compression occurs in the non-school district
yes.
taxes because of the effect of the court case.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think it's also a function of the fact that the school's portion was $5.25,
yeah.
and that 25 over the $5 was really a much smaller portion than the $12, the $2 is to the 10, it being 20% of the over the top of, in effect, over the compression limits. So I think that's an algebraic and a numeral formation of it.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was the toughest example. It's all downhill from this point on.
Well, this does illustrate, doesn't it, the effect of reading two different constitutional provisions together, because that's what the court did.
Yes.
And so a complex constitutional provision like the one in Measure 5 may very well have consequences different than you've thought about once you have read the rest of a complicated document called the Oregon Constitution.
Yes, yes, that's why I said they may not, the original intent may have been to do A and B, but there are some consequences. There have been some side effects that may not have been intended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Again, my hope would be that as we hear these UR cases and other kinds of legislation that the Revenue Committee which is wanting to discuss, that we'll actually take a look at real case scenarios of high, medium, low issues that taxpayers would be affected. And last session, we asked Mary to actually bring us examples of those kinds of things so that we could walk through the numbers rather than just the theory of it. I think it always helps me, at least, to walk through the numbers and then try and apply the theory, and that way we get a better feel for it.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay. This is the additional piece that the assessors might have covered that I'm going to try to cover briefly for you. Okay. The federal forest revenues that are important to so many counties, county taxing districts, pertains to this legislation that was enacted in 1908 when the federal government dedicated 25% of all revenues from the management of two land grants totaling 2.5 million acres of forest lands to local government services, public schools, and rural schools. In 1937, Congress granted the counties revenues from the sale of timber on these lands in perpetuity. During the 1990s, there was a decline in forest revenues due to a change in forest management practices, at which point the Congress guaranteed minimum federal forest payments on all of 6 million acres of forest land to counties until September 2006. Here are the said September 2006. So basically, the counties that were receiving these monies are no longer receiving these monies in the current year. And as of 2005-06, there's roughly about $228 million here, of which most third will probably come out of road construction. Another half will impact general funds for local tax counties, taxing districts, and the balance will impact school funding. Just breaking down the losses in terms of eastern and western parts of the state.
Excuse me just a moment. This is the annual cost.
Yes.
So statewide, on the way we think about things, it's almost $500 million.
Yes, if you're looking for
annual. Biennially. Thank you.
Okay, this is, again, 0304 data that I received from the Association of Counties, and it breaks down the data by region of the state, most of which you can see will impact Western Oregon. This particular table, I think, really highlights which counties will most heavily be impacted by loss in forest revenues. Here in Eastern Oregon, I'm going to hit that one here. You can see that Grant County will be mostly affected by forest revenues. But you can see the other counties predominantly relying on property taxes would be more than likely affected by property tax compression issues. In Western Oregon, this graph highlights just how important the federal revenues are here. You can see all but Linn County are located in the southwest, and Linn, of course, is just above Douglas County. The losses are very astonishing if you compare them to the other major sources of property, such as property taxes. For example, across these five counties in FY05-06, property taxes of $77 million
would have to triple in order to offset the losses. For Douglas County, property taxes would have to increase almost 700%, and that's impossible. From the hearings that we had with the Senate last week, when this was presented, they don't have the capacity to, compression would set in, but it's virtually impossible to think of raising taxes that much. Some policy questions might be considered. At the end of the presentation, I wanted to mention them. There are some policy issues that were discussed at the Senate Revenue Committee, and I mentioned these as well, talking about what the state's role is in helping the counties that are in this crisis with regard to the emergencies they're in right now. But I think it also, the fact that compression is not going to, or that the western counties are not going to be able to grow their property taxes because of compression, and they're going to have to look for other sources, and they're going to have to look to the state to help them, it really raises the question of compression again, and maybe it will get more attention because it affects any local taxing district where revenue value, real market values of property are flat or declining, and it affects districts that are doing nothing to change their rates from last year, but perhaps because of the interdependence that these taxing districts have within each code area could be forced into compression, again because of the real market values not growing as fast as might have previously been anticipated. And, of course, with urban renewal being expanded, if these plans are expanded or amended, I should say, it can affect non-school taxing districts, put them into compression as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary, it seems like one of the unusual features of our system now is that even when property is sold, we don't reassess to catch up with the market value. And so if you look at some of your earlier charts, it looks like the real value of, I mean, the market value of the property is going way up and the assessed value is relatively flat. Do you know how unusual that feature is for states that have gone down this path? I know when people move here, they're always shocked to find out that property doesn't get reassessed.
Because we had done a study there back in 1992. I don't want to date myself here. But the study did show the turnover rate was usually about every 5 to 7 years. Less on the very expensive properties, so that the amendment that we called it the Save Our Homes Amendment was rather regressive in that sense. But, I mean, at least it was turning over every 5 to 7 years for most of the property, and that brings the value up. I just read in tax notes the other day, though, that Florida is even considering some changes to this, to that, because it's been very difficult, even with their constraints, to cap it to 3% on assessed value, that it's been very difficult to keep services up to level.
Mr. Chair.
Mason.
Representative Rosenbaum, there was a time when the counties had really important vested interest, if you will, to reassess because they were taxing on real market value. Ever since the assessed value with Measure 5 and Measure 50 came in, the assessed value is almost fixed, and it has an automatic ladder that keeps going up. So there is no additional benefit, if you will, of finding what real market value is. It really doesn't make it. The only place that it might make a difference is when you go on bonds that are not subject to Measure 5 type of thing. That's
capital construction.
Right. But in that, there is really no incentive for counties to have assessments going every 3 years or every 4 years, 5 years to capture the real market value of that sense. Mm-hmm. And the CPR, of course, that one that Mary has talked about, keeps the percentage between what assessed and real market value on new property is the same, so that also works automatically as well.
although these numbers do, don't they, are important for the compression issue, aren't they? Because market value would tend to work you out of compression if it went up.
That's true, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. But, of course, the county may not have an interest of its own in evaluating that because the people who are compressed may not necessarily be the county, maybe except in some small areas. It's the other taxing districts that have serious effects from it. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is that when we see in other states' taxing systems, RMV versus AV, the assessed value is typically for some specific exemption, a homeowner's exemption, a veteran's exemption, or something like that, as opposed to Oregon, which has a whole series of issues that deal with what is the assessed value and the kinds of things that can happen to assess value based upon exceptions to the property, change in the use of the property, additions to the property over certain amounts. I notice, Mr. Chair, that we're going to have assessors coming in the next week or so, and it would be good for them to tell their story and to be able to tell what they go through and again give some examples. But the concern that I had, and the question I asked Representative Rosenbaum, is Prop 13 in California, when the property turns over, you get a new assessed value, which is the real market value, the market value for which it turned. The question we had was, is there any, if I say, Jimmy, I really like this home, I think I'll stay here for 30 years. On the 29th year, am I still paying tax, the 1.5%, based upon my original purchase price, or is there an indexing in there in California's Prop 13? Do we know?
I thought it was indexed, 3%.
So they do have a 3% on top of the 1.5%.
I thought so.
Okay. Well, that'd be reasonable. Be reasonable. So there is an AV difference from RMV at that point in California.
I think so.
Other questions, discussion? A number of issues have been raised here. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does Oregon compare to our neighboring states in terms of the impact of the loss of the federal forest revenues?
In terms of the what?
The impact of the loss of the federal forest revenues. That federal shift, how does that impact Oregon compared to other states with
I can get some timber. Numbers for you, but I'm fairly sure that a huge portion of the impact will fall in Oregon. I'll get some numbers for you.
That would be great. Thank you.
Of course, other states that may be impacted also have smaller populations. Representative Witt?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to comment that the revenue that we receive from those payments is greater than all the other states combined, so Oregon takes an exceptionally large hit.
That's because of the fact the federal government owns us, Mr. Chair.
They also own Nevada, but of course Nevada doesn't have any trees, so.
Yeah, they got trees.
Occasionally, there might be one. Let me ask you, while we're on the topic, let me ask you a very general question without binding anybody, because we don't have any bills in front of us about it, but are the committee members inclined to look at some potential solutions, without committing yourself to what those might be, to this issue? I mean, it occurs to me as I raise the question that we're at $500 million a biennium is a great deal of money, even in the modern era, and there's a huge differential effect, and some counties aren't affected at all, and others are affected greatly, and there are a number of policy questions beyond the ones on the screen, in addition to questions that have to do with how one would go about raising that much money. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me that does fall within the purview of this committee. I know the Senate committee is also looking at some of these issues. Maybe rather than asking a question, I should simply say, bring your ideas and be prepared to spend some time on this issue later on as we move along. A final comment on that point, for me at least, is that remember we have Monday at 5 o'clock next week to get requests for drafting to Legislative Council. So there's not much time for anybody who has ideas to get them in. Are there other matters to come before the committee today? Other questions? Thoughts? If not, you get an early reprieve, an early dismissal, and a chance to do some other work before 3 o'clock committees. We are adjourned.